Hi, it's Tony Bruschi from Real Ghost Stories Online, inviting you to subscribe to our other podcast called The Grave Talks. It's where I sit down and interview individuals who've had extreme paranormal situations happen to them in their lives. Just search The Grave Talks on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Be sure to press subscribe and give us some stars to help spread the word that this show exists. Now, here's a 15-minute preview of The Grave Talks. Today on The Grave Talks, the haunted old Charleston jail. These days, it seems, if a building is still standing past the age of 30, it almost inevitably has a ghost story attached to it. If a building has been standing for nearly 200 years, it likely holds hundreds of ghost stories. Add to that fact that the building was built on a burial ground and imprisoned those deserving and not through one of the darkest periods in American history. You then have a structure almost glowing with the paranormal. That building is the haunted old Charleston jail. But who are the ghosts of the old Charleston jail? This is not a haunting with one lone spirit. This is a haunting with literally hundreds of ghosts, some from the days of the jail, other ghosts from a time period dating back to the 1700s prior to its construction. One of the most compelling ghost stories of the old Charleston jail involves a woman named Lavinia and her husband. The couple for many years would lure unsuspecting travelers to their hotel, drug them, murder them, and then steal their belongings. After many years of running their scheme, they were tried and hanged. Before their death, Lavinia pledged that she would see the devil herself and ask the locals if they had any messages for the Dark Emperor before she was hanged. It seems she didn't get very deep into the bowels of the underworld, as her spirit still lingers in the halls of the jail to this day. One of the most shocking facts of the old Charleston jail is the fact that up until the late 1930s, it was operated and housed both local and federal prisoners. Without running water, plumbing, or electricity. It was truly a cruel and unusual medieval-style prison operating in the United States at the same time Bing Crosby and Ella Fitzgerald were on the radio. It's no wonder the restless souls still linger there today.
Well, it's a little more difficult for me to portray an initial impression because I have become quite enamored with the building and the location because I've been working there now for well over 2 years. And I grew up here. I'm a native Charlestonian. And so during my childhood, there were moments when my parents would go visit someone downtown and we would turn the corner on Franklin Street or on Magazine, and the building would loom large as you rounded the corner. But I think I can tell you that for the average person visiting Charleston, as you walk down Magazine Street or come at it from Queen, you realize that you're looking at something that is truly an anomaly, that it shouldn't be there, that there's something wrong. Why is this medieval-looking Gothic building with crenellated towers, you know, looming up in the middle of this otherwise fairly modern looking neighborhood? Now, you know, there is no such thing as truly modern in Charleston because there are always older buildings pickled around and stuck inside more modern structures. But in the area where we are, because of an earthquake that struck Charleston in 1886 and took everything else out, there is this no man's land around the building as well, which adds to the creepiness. You know, it's open, which is unusual because the city is very dense. So, but when you come around, you look at this thing, it looms up three stories. The two towers in the front on Magazine Street actually loom up an additional story. So they're four stories high, so they stand up above the rest of the structure and they look down. It's gray. It's dismal looking. There's no color. The bars on the windows, which were original to the jail as it was built in 1802, are rusted. The doors are also from the original period construction. They've faded over the years, and so the whole building blends into like a mass of gloom. And you look at it and you start to piece it apart. You notice that there are different sections to it. And as you walk around it, and the yard is quite wide, it's no man's land. As you walk around, you just become amazed at how this thing could still be standing here after all those years. Why it wasn't bulldozed long ago in some modern condominium complex built in its place. But this is Charleston. And we have the oldest preservation ordinance in the country. It was adopted in 1930. And so when this building did wind up becoming vacant, still belonging to the city in 1939, the city of Charleston had the wherewithal and the foresight to simply sit on it for 60 years, just let it sit there empty. And that adds to the mystique, because when something sits like that long, empty, it seems to attract things. And that's also the impression you get from the jail, is that it's not just the misery and the suffering and the hangings and the disease, the yellow fever that swept through and killed all those people. It's not just that. There's something else that's added to it, and it's that neglect. And it comes through as you watch and as you walk around it.
Take us back to the very beginning of when this structure was built, why it was built, and what life was like in Charleston at that time.
Well, it all pivots around the date 1802. And up until 1802, Charleston had relied upon the old dungeon underneath the Exchange Building, which still exists, but it's about 10 blocks away, had relied upon that dungeon as a place to incarcerate criminals. Up until that time, in the dungeon, which dates back to 1680, when the settlers first arrived from England, that dungeon never had cages. That was not a concept in English penal systems. It was you relied upon the walls and the floors to shackle people, to hold them, until you were going to do one of two things with them. You were either going to hang them, or you were going to hurt them and then let them go. And that mindset was shifting in 1802. The city was very wealthy. It had gone through a few hard times after the Revolutionary War, which was only about 20 some odd years previous. And the city was ready to become, it was making statements. It was trying to show off its wealth. And one thing it decided it needed to do was it looked to England, it looked to New York, and saw what they were doing with the penal system and began to copy them. But they also wanted to go one step forward and be better than everybody else, because the city had that mindset as well. And so when they built this thing, it was meant to be state of the art. And what that meant to them in 1802 was cages, lots and lots and lots of cages, because they were going to hold people for periods of time now beyond what they had done in the past. In the past, when you brought people in to hang them or hurt them, it was expedited because there wasn't very little room. But now we're going to open it up. We're going to have rooms with cages where we can hold people, and we'll have an opportunity to work with them. And in the United States at that time, and again, this had begun in England, there were reformers in the system, mainly people of strong religious faith, mainly Baptists and Quakers, who were advocating that a penal system should provide a source of reform. It should provide prisoners with an opportunity to see the error of their ways and to make them better people. Now, these Christian reformists were not necessarily going to change the outcome. People were still going to be hurt. They're still going to be hanged, or they're going to be hurt and released. But at least we're going to have a time here to put them behind bars, make them sit and think about what they're doing. And that is why today, when we see a structure like that, one of the words that pops up in the English language is penitentiary, because they wanted these people to be penitent. Now, that's a very cute idea to us. It's very naive, because we know that's not true. We know, because we've become jaded over the centuries, we know that criminals are criminals, that reform has been attempted in the past and is probably not a very necessary, and of course this is very political in and of itself, not necessarily a productive use of resources. What we're really trying to do is protect the public. But back then, it was this noble effort to bring people in and offer them a chance to stop their sins, and then perhaps if they were released, it would give them an opportunity to become better citizens. And then if they weren't released, if they were hanged, at least they would go after having made peace with their creator. And that was what motivated all of this. There was a lot of talk about it, and they put their money down. They didn't have a lot, but they authorized the building, and they began construction in the late 1790s. And by 1802, it had been completed, at least in its core section. It was all completed, and they began to take prisoners in 1803, and for the first time had the option of throwing them in cages.
So once it was physically there, up, running, and the attempts at reform began, how did that go?
It didn't go well. It didn't go well, because the folks who were advocating these reforms did not wind up, surprise, surprise, being the people who were actually running the jail. The people running the jail, and this is something that you get as you read through the histories that are available to us, the scholarship and some of the archival records that are still left here in the city, and also from Union memoirs, strangely enough, written by Union soldiers who have been kept prisoners there as POWs in the Civil War. What you realize is that it became something entirely different from its original intent. It became just the opposite of what was intended, because in addition to building the structure in 1802, they also built around it a wall 20 feet high. And that set the tone, because what that did was isolate that structure from the rest of Charleston society, and it became a secret place. It became a gulag. And when people went in there, it became common knowledge that you would be very lucky if you ever came out. And it was because of the lack of facilities. There was, when this thing was shut in 1939, it did not have running water. It had no plumbing. It had no electricity. They had not even bothered to put gas lights in the jail. So this thing sunk into the unconscious of Charleston's political elite. It became a place where something happened, like a black box, and they didn't care what it was. And I have to say, and this is going to come up in the interview, one reason for that is because they were already doing that to the enslaved people. And what happened was, once you launch a program of cruelty, sadism, and brutal repression on a group of people who are enslaved, suddenly what you might or might not do to people of European descent in the old city jail pales in comparison, and the bar is set very low. And that's what happened with the jail.
I hope you enjoyed your 15-minute preview of our new podcast, The Grave Talks. Be sure to subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download podcasts to not miss any episode of the show. New episodes every single Monday. Just search for The Grave Talks and then press subscribe. Give us a review while you're at it and some stars. That will help us grow in the rankings and let other folks know that the show exists to make an even better show for you. The Grave Talks. Check it out at thegravetalks.com.